Hi, everyone. Welcome to Waste 360's Nothing Wasted podcast. On every episode, we invite the most interesting people in waste, recycling, and organics to sit down with us and chat candidly about their thoughts, their work, this unique industry, and so much more. So thanks for listening and enjoy this episode. One of the best things about this podcast is learning about the latest technologies and innovation in our industry. And that's why we're delighted to introduce Juno, a breakthrough waste recovery technology that's proven to recover up to 90%, yes, 90% of materials it processes, diverting them from landfills and incinerators. And these materials, things like paper fiber, plastics, and metals, are then circulated back into the economy for reuse as raw materials. So talk about a circular solution. If you would like to learn more, visit gpjuno.com. That's gpjuno.com.
Thank you again for attending the session on government's role in funding recycling infrastructure. My name is Rachel Oster. I'm the owner of Diversion Strategies. We're a waste and recycling consulting firm based in Sacramento, California. I'm also the co-founder of Women in Solid Waste and Recycling, which is a nonprofit organization focused on diversifying the industry by giving women the tools and resources and network they need to be successful leaders. And you can go to the CPG booth at 12:30. We're having a little power break there to celebrate Wiser and have a little networking. And please find me on LinkedIn. I don't do business cards anymore. It's wasteful. So LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, we're all over everything. Okay, so this morning we're here to talk about the shared responsibility of improving, upgrading, and evolving our waste management infrastructure. When the first recycling programs were being rolled out across the country 30, 40, 50 years ago, that's when many of the material recovery facilities and recycling facilities across the nation were designed and built. And many of the solid waste management facilities we see today are built to be amortized over a 30-year or so life. So, you know, 30 to 40 years ago, the waste stream looked a lot different than it does now. I mean, just think about what has happened to our waste stream since then. One, the proliferation of plastic packaging. Two, Amazon and, you know, all the cardboard that comes with Amazon. Plastic water bottles, right? Did we see those 30, 40 years ago? Beer moving from glass to aluminum cans. Newspapers. I mean, the list goes on. We don't use newspapers anymore. The list goes on and on. So as the waste and recycling industry continues to be asked to be a part of the solution for climate change by sorting and processing more of our waste streams, our facilities will have to evolve to match the ever-evolving makeup of our waste stream. And California has really led the way in terms of creating policy requiring greater diversion from landfill to higher and better uses. Everybody knows this. California is a leader in that. But because of this, California is put in the unique position to spearhead many great grant and financial incentive programs that are meant to assist in the development of this new infrastructure, of not just new, but innovative infrastructure and upgrades to old infrastructure that will help California achieve its recycling goals. So today, we're going to hear from this amazing panel of experts about the types of programs that have successfully supported the development of new solid waste and recycling infrastructure in California. Our hope is that these programs can be replicated in other states as they also push toward more aggressive recycling goals. We're all in this together, right? And here we have the speakers today. We have the Honorable Treasurer Fiona Ma from the state of California to talk about, yes? Thank you for being here, Fiona. So Fiona Ma is one of this industry's best advocates. Out of all of my time in the industry, which is 15 years, I've worked with a lot of elected officials, and I haven't seen anyone dedicate as much time and energy into learning the boots on the ground aspects of this industry as Fiona. Her heels and shoes and boots have probably been on as many recycling and solid waste facility floors as mine have, and that's saying a lot. So happy to have Fiona here. We also have the CEO of Recology, Sal Coniglio. And Laura Ferrante, who's the commissioner on the statewide commission on curbside recycling and markets in California, and also the grant expert. I mean, if you want to know about grants, Laura is your person. And then we have, yes, and then we have Chris Wirth here as well, Vice President of Business Development and Government Affairs at AMP Robotics, one of the innovators that are looking to evolve our recycling infrastructure into the next generation. Thank you, Chris, for being here. Okay, so up first we is Treasurer Fiona Ma here to talk about the programs that the Treasurer's Office offers to the waste and recycling industry, financial incentives.
Yeah, so thank you very much. I'm proud to be a trashy lady. I finally have a name. But it's my honor to be here. The Treasurer's Office, I am the state's banker, so all of the money comes into my office. Last year it was $3.2 trillion. I oversee a short-term portfolio of about $227 billion, and I issue all the bonds for the state of California, general obligation, revenue bonds, as well as for the CSU and the UC systems. I also oversee 15 boards, commissions, and authorities that funds and finances affordable housing, schools, hospitals, green energy, public transportation, advanced manufacturing, and the likes. So the program that we work most closely with this industry is our sales tax exemption program. It is a very competitive program now because lots of companies who are coming to California to clean and green the environment, they can apply to waive their sales taxes on their expensive equipment. And so this has been a real game changer. As many people know, California, it's hard for us to compete against some of the other states. And so people always say, what can California do? So one of it is our sales tax exemption program, which I chair. Another one is our Cal Competes program. If you are thinking about coming and expanding in the state of California, you can apply for an income tax deferral of 3 to 5 years. And this is really to incentivize folks to hire people, save some of their tax revenues, and then hopefully when they are up and running, they'll be paying their taxes later down the road. But I do want to talk about some of my bills later, so I'm going to you can leave me some time, because I've got some fun stories for you all.
Yes. All right. Yes, thank you for that great overview of the programs. And we're going to be getting into a little bit more. So this, I've failed to go over what the setup is going to be today, but we're going to have a few presentations from each of our panelists and then some questions in between. And then at the end, hold your questions. At the end, everybody will have about 10 to 15 minutes to ask any questions that you have as well. Okay, so I am going to start with just a few questions here in between each of the presentations. So the first one I have here is for Treasurer Ma. Why do you think sales and use tax exclusion programs are so popular and successful in attracting development in California?
Yeah, so a lot of the equipment that you all buy and others obviously cost a lot of money, and sometimes they have to be shipped in from other countries. And so saving that 10 to maybe 11% in sales and use tax is an incentive that we can offer. I also forgot to say that I issue the bonds through CPCFA and CIDLAC that helps many of our companies expand their facilities, buy equipment. And so that is through our California Debt Limit Allocation Committee. And so if you're looking to expand, please think of us.
No, it certainly has been. And I know the California Pollution and Control Financing Authority, which falls under the Treasurer's Office, has been a program that was used to buy trucks to come into compliance with ever-changing air regulations. Just an example of another program that's been really helpful to this industry offered by the state of California. And this question is for Laura. I know that you've worked on some of these applications for sales and use tax exclusions. What types of equipments I mean, you know, we mentioned vehicles, but what other types of equipments and projects from our industry are typically applying?
Yes, as Fiona mentioned, it's mostly equipment, MRF equipment, composting facility equipment, any, what's it term, qualified property that has a useful life of over 1 year that can be used to process recycled feedstock or use recycled feedstock to make new products. That's what is typically exempted under that program. Up to I think it's $10 million per applicant per year. So it's quite sizable.
I know for many of our clients, it's been a real help in just adjusting the P&L and in the development of these facilities. For you, Chris, from AMP Robotics' perspective, like how would an innovative company, okay, so AMP isn't building MRFs, but they are building technology to help support MRFs, like how would a company like AMP utilize this type of program?
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of ties right back into what you've been saying, where it benefits our customers, the adoption of new technology, you know, really, you know, and, you know, whether it's in MRFs or whether plastics converters, et cetera, I mean, the adoption of new technology in order to modernize, create operational efficiencies, you know, there's a scale to that, mm-hmm. right? And there's an adoption curve to that. There's other implications of infrastructure that's needed to kind of adapt either existing facilities or outfit new. So I think it very much plays into it. And then even, you know, even for us, as we continue to expand our model, you know, we're starting to build supplementary infrastructure to support MRFs as well. So as we look at, you know, building, getting into some of the facilities to do that, it has actually a direct impact as well in our business model. And we see it, you know, all over the country in order to modernize a system, and then working with leaders like Recology, where there is, you know, progressive adoption of technology, it's really important.
Thank you, Chris. And finally, Sal, I know that you're going to jump into this in some detail in your presentation, just talking about the projects that Recology has specifically developed utilizing these incentives. But, you know, Recology is a vertically integrated company, so different from AMP, so different perspective. But can you tell us about how, you know, Recology views these type of programs from the innovation perspective? Like, how does it help Recology innovate?
Thank you, Rachel. Yeah, I cover a little bit of this and talk about some of the examples over the last couple of years that we've implemented, but it's a great opportunity for us to offset the capital expense and invest in robotics or other components to make, you know, increase diversion, takes more trucks off the road, build out compost facilities. So for us, it's just a great opportunity to offset those mm-hmm. costs because it's pretty expensive. So that's why you have to dedicate resources to find these programs and pay attention to these programs and manage them, you know, to get through the application process and get through it effectively.
Thanks, Sal. Thank you. Okay, well, Sal, with that, I think it's a good transition into your presentation. Sal is going to be sharing with us some examples of projects that Recology has specifically used these programs.
Sal Cunilio, the CEO of Recology. To give you a little overview of our company and who we are and what we look like. We are a 100% employee-owned company spanning across the West Coast from Seattle through parts of Oregon into San Francisco and down into the Central Valley of California. And we've been in business for over 100 years, something that we're really proud of. There we go. So 3,800 employees. We service over 137 communities on the West Coast, 26 operating companies, 24 transfer stations, 14 material recovery facilities, and we have approximately 8 compost operations, 5 in California. One project that I'd like just to point out, we talked about the sales tax exclusion program. We purchased a hauling company, in Sonoma Marin, the Ratto company, about 4 years ago. And that's in that company we serviced, we picked up all the cities in Sonoma County, but not the town of Sonoma or Windsor. We also service Nevado and Petaluma in Marin County. With that acquisition, we picked up a MRF. And that MRF was old and needed some help. And that's kind of the last component of finalizing that acquisition was to upgrade that MRF. That was kind of like as we get to the fourth year, that was our plan as we convert that company into a Recology company. With that facility, we're now able to process all those tons, all the mixed recyclables. We collect about 300 tons per day, but we can only process about 90 tons. So with that, we made a decision to invest in that facility, that MRF, and modernize that facility. We're going to make a $15 million investment in that facility, a new equipment. We're going with a MachineX program or machine. And with that, we are able to apply for the STE program, and we're able to capture about a $1.5 million offset in sales tax deferral because this is, you know, one of those projects that applies for that. So we're really excited to move forward with that modernization program and offset some of those that expense. Another project that I'd like to just to highlight is the CalRecycle Organics Infrastructure Grant that we received a few years ago. We have a compost facility in Wheatland, California, and as we're gearing up for 1383, we built a new facility. This facility is situated at near our Ostrom Road landfill, and that facility is going to be built over several phases. It's permitted for 2,000 tons per day. We built out the first phase. It's kind of hard to see here, but the 250 tons per day is the first phase of that facility. And over time, we're going to build that facility, and it's an advanced ASP program. The first phase costs us in CapEx about $7.5 to $8 million to build out that first phase. But with the CalRecycle Grants Program, we were able to offset that capital cost by $2.5 million approximately. So it was a huge benefit to the company. I mean, with that, we could, you know, invest in higher, you know, better ASP technology and help offset that expense. That facility, a little bit more about the facility, is 100%, it's powered by 100% renewable energy. The energy coming from the landfill is you know, fueling that site, powering the site, advanced ASP, and it's a mass bed configuration. So I just want to give just some of the couple of projects that we were able to get some offsets over the last couple of years. We continue to look for those opportunities as we continue to grow the company and retrofit the company and modernize all our different facilities. So those are just a couple of examples that I wanted to share with this group.
Thank you so much, Sal, for sharing those examples. And I know everybody got a little teaser there with this $3 million grant. We only heard about sales and use tax exemptions. This is grant. Well, have the grant expert to come explain to you about where those grants came from. So what we'll do here is, Laura, if you want to come up and give your presentation, and then we'll have a little panel discussion on the California grant program.
Good morning, everyone. As Rachel mentioned, I am a commissioner on the California State Recycling Commission. It's one of my hats, but I'm also an industry consultant. My firm is called Waste Alternatives. I've been in the industry over 9 years now. I started with Recology for quite a while doing government affairs for Recology, and now as a consultant, I work primarily with the Resource Recovery Coalition of California as their legislative advocate. The Resource Coalition is a trade association comprised of waste and recycling companies throughout California, and many of those companies, as we discussed already, have used the CAFA, Sales and Use Tax Exemption Program, and the CPCFA program under the Treasurer's Office to great success. They've been incredible programs for our members, for the industry in California, in growing infrastructure and bringing in innovative technology and equipment into the MRFs and the composting, et cetera. So I'm here though today because in the last 5 years or so, I've started writing grants. Most of the experience I have at this point is with the CalRecycle grants, the grants administered by CalRecycle, which provide funding to projects that create additional waste diversion in California. So we're particularly excited right now because last year's state budget in California allocated $270 million over 2 years to support the development of a circular economy in the state, which is by far the most that we've ever seen at one time. It's quite incredible. This money will flow through some of the many grant and loan and payment programs that CalRecycle administers. These programs, there's a wide variety of programs through CalRecycle that support recycling, market development, beverage container recycling, household hazardous waste management, used oil, waste tires, you name it. But I'm going to focus today primarily on the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Grant and Loan Program, which provides financial incentives for capital investment in recycling infrastructure that will specifically reduce greenhouse gas emissions in California. Those programs focus mainly on composting, anaerobic digestion, and recycling and manufacturing facilities that will divert additional material from landfill and, of course, reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So much of this $270 million here that you see on the slide, particularly in that first investment category, organic waste infrastructure and implementation, that's $195 million dedicated to supporting CalRecycle's organic waste recycling mandate under Senate Bill 1383, which was passed in 2016 but was finally implemented and went into effect earlier this year, January 1. So that mandate requires that California reduce disposal of organic waste by 75% of the 2014 level by 2025. It is a hugely ambitious and aggressive diversion goal. And in developing the regulations and figuring out how we were going to make this work, CalRecycle estimated that achieving that goal would require over 160 new and expanded organic waste processing facilities throughout California, composting facilities, anaerobic digestion facilities primarily. Additionally, CalRecycle said, well, that's a lot. What's it going to cost? So they estimated that developing that infrastructure and other program implementation costs would be upwards of $10 billion by 2030, a significant amount of money. And there is no funding component to this organics mandate, which means the vast majority of that $10 billion has to be covered by rates, by ratepayers. So we're super excited to see this $270 million, particularly $195 million to organic waste infrastructure to help with implementing 1383, particularly in light of the tumultuous, to say the least, past couple of years and economic hardship that many of our ratepayers in California are facing. So we're super pumped to see this kind of money for recycling, for circular economy, for organics processing infrastructure. So as I mentioned, the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Grant and Loan Programs promote infrastructure development to increase waste diversion and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This program also prioritizes environmental and economic benefits in disadvantaged and low-income communities. Generally, this program, the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Grant and Loan Program, generally it's funded by auction proceeds from California's Cap and Trade Program, but due to the historic surplus in last year's state budget, many of these programs got a one-time boost in funding from the state's general fund, which is why we're seeing $270 million for circular economy. So under this program, there are currently six grant programs and one loan program, though I'm really just going to focus on the grant programs. And they include what you see on the slide here, the organics grant program that Sal talked about a little bit already. This program provides up to $3 million in awards for developing new or expanded organic waste processing facilities, specifically composting and anaerobic digestion facilities that, of course, increase diversion of organic material away from landfills. So I did write two grant applications under this program, the one being for Recology, congratulations. and another one more recently to fund an organic screw press system that will to recover wet organic material from MSW and send that for composting. The next one on the slide is a recycled fiber, plastic, and glass grant program that supports facilities that use post-consumer recycled fiber, plastic or glass to manufacture products. And as you can see, $35.5 million have been awarded under that program to date. The Food Waste Prevention and Rescue Grant Program, this is a great program as well, particularly because there is a food waste prevention and food rescue component to the organics recycling mandate under 1383 that we just mentioned. This program supports projects that prevent food waste from being generated in the first place and then also recovers edible food destined for landfill and redistributes it to people in need. So I wrote an application for this one as well that awarded $500,000 to a technology company that uses its program to match food donation with food need in an effort to avoid wasted donations. And they also use existing third-party food delivery service providers like DoorDash, and which is actually pretty cool that they use the existing transportation infrastructure. And then on the other side are some of the more recent grant programs, the Community Composting Grant Program, which increases the number and capacity of small-scale composting programs in community green spaces, specifically within disadvantaged and low-income communities in California. And this is a relatively new grant, but there is an additional $5 million over the next 2 years committed to this program. The reuse grant focuses on source reduction through reuse. It's another new program, $2 million has been awarded so far. And the co-digestion grant program is the most recent one. This program will fund new and expanded food waste co-digestion projects at existing wastewater treatment plants. Last year's state budget allocated $20 million over 2 years to this grant program, which is pretty exciting. And the final slide is just a snapshot of some the timeline of the upcoming grant activity at CalRecycle. Most notably, the next solicitation for the organics grant will be in the fall. I know it's a little bit difficult to see, but all this information is, of course, available at CalRecycle's website. I feel like I'm the CalRecycle spokesperson here today. But the next solicitation of that will begin in the fall, and there is $70 million available for that solicitation this year, which is, again, the most that program has ever had at one time. The budget last year did give more money than that to this program, to organics infrastructure development. I think it was over $30 million that has already been awarded earlier this year to existing projects that had applied for this program a couple of years ago and qualified but weren't funded because the program ran out of money. So CalRecycle reevaluated those projects and determined that most of them, or however many of them, still qualified and still could use the money. And so they awarded it right away, which was great. Bottom, I'll note the recycling technology grant, which we did not discuss. It's not really under the greenhouse gas reduction grant program. But that is that's a new program, which is exciting for recycling technology and feasibility, which was given $15 million over 2 years in the state budget. So that's just a quick rundown of the very, very popular CalRecycle grant programs. There is a lot of money available right now for those programs.
Thank you, Laura. We're going to take a little bit of time here now in between to ask some questions of our panelists. So I'll let you sit down first, Laura, but I know you alluded to some of this money being because we in California there's a large budget surplus, but do you think that these funds will continue to be available? Do you think that these funds will continue to be available, or is this like a short-term thing? It's going to happen this year and next, and then.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's kind of a short-term thing. I hope it's not. I don't think. Yeah. I think that the administration is finally realizing that we do need significant investment in this infrastructure if we're going to be successful with implementing 1383 and reaching our organic waste diversion targets. That said, this money is available now. So I think in this year we're going to see some more maybe, but I don't think we're going to see this level of funding for a while. I am hopeful that we will see more than we had before this big surplus. But this is an historic surplus. This is an incredible amount of money that's available right now.
Yes, I'm going to just jump in. So even during the pandemic, the last 2 years, we've seen record surpluses, which was shocking to all of us. But people were still getting their bonuses, and mostly in the tech sectors, paying capital gains. As you know, everybody probably got a Robinhood account, and so everyone was, paying taxes. And the third thing is sales taxes. People were still shopping online. And so that's where we saw this increase, this surplus. In California, we have something called the GAN limits. When we have too much revenues, we can only distribute it a certain way. Number one is to infrastructure projects. Number two, state and local governments have their own GAN limits, so we can send money down to local governments. And the third way is rebates, refunds, giving it back to the people. For those of you who work in California, how many of you work in California? Okay, as you know, we are more than two-thirds democratically controlled. I am a Democrat, but Democrats don't like to return money. So now is the opportunity for you to lobby your assembly member and your senator and the governor and let them know what infrastructure projects you have or your local government. Now is the time. So we are trying to figure out, like I said to the texted, you know, the governor saying, hey, let's help the fairgrounds, right? We have 70 fairgrounds in California. Many of them have aged in infrastructure. They can all use infrastructure money. But if you all have any good ideas, definitely let them know. Like, you need your voices to be heard, because I know your industry is very quiet. You don't like to complain a lot. We can't sometimes raise the rates in certain jurisdictions without having a, you know, a free-for-all, as Sal knows, in San Francisco. And so now is the time to, you know, apply for or ask for these type of grant and, you know, infrastructure dollars.
Rachel, I want to also add that I mentioned, you know, this is an incredible amount of money that we're seeing, but this is not unique to California either. I mean, I think by far the most is available in California right now, but we're seeing greater emphasis on developing recycling programs and recycling infrastructure throughout the country. This grant money and loan money and sales and use tax exemption programs are available in a lot of other states. And as Fiona mentioned, I think we're going to see a lot of money come available under the infrastructure, the federal infrastructure bill as well, for recycling infrastructure and recycling programs. So for those of you that are particularly that are technology providers or equipment providers that operate in other states beyond California, there is a lot of money available for you in those other states and available for partnership opportunities.
Yeah, thank you, Laura. Definitely worth mentioning all that's becoming available. Even federally, we saw the federal infrastructure grant have quite a bit of money for the recycling industry. So I guess we're speaking up and, you know, could speak up more. I love what you said, Fiona, about a quiet industry. You know, a lot of times we operate under the dark of the night. You know, it's how it's built. But we've got to be loud and proud about our role in combating climate change and definitely talk to our electeds about what we need to get there to meet these aggressive goals and help combat climate change. Sal, a question for you on these grants. I know many of them require partnerships, whether it's local government or I know many of the organics grants required some element of food recovery too. They wanted to, you know, ensure that some of the money is not just going to build the infrastructure to take food waste, but that there's also some sort of partnership or understanding that we need to recover food, edible food, to feed hungry people. So just curious how Recology goes about finding partners for these projects. And
well, in terms of edible food, we haven't explored that too much. So we haven't really embarked on an edible food recovery program. It's for us, it's really been, you know, what can we do to compost better, more efficiently, you know, reduce the VOC. So we use these opportunities to, you know, help us build out those facilities. But we have not gone that far mm-hmm. with edible food programs.
Okay. Chris, you know, you've been part of the growth team for several tech startups, and tell us how important grant funding is for and demonstrating, you know, innovative technologies for when you're going after capital investment, finding investors. How important is it that the government is also, you know, providing grants, and how do they look at that typically from an investment standpoint?
Yeah, no, I think that's that's a great question, because I think we look at it, or I'll provide two perspectives. You know, one, last 4 years have been in, you know, the recycling, material recovery space. Prior to that, 10 years in solar, renewable energy. A lot of our same investors that have come into, you know, Amp Robotics have a history of clean tech, have a history of kind of that call it kind of 1.0 of clean tech, and now more and more climate tech. So what we've seen is, again, California being the lead, because it also sets the tone for the rest of the country, sets the tone for the adoption of technology, different business models, asset management, et cetera, which then really stimulates the private investment from venture capital often. Also, investment from the federal side and the state side for innovation. So it's very, very critical. I mean, we have our immediate, example. Our founder, Dr. Bentanya Horowitz, graduate of Caltech, came out of Caltech, had looked at different innovation technologies, intersection of AI, robotics. How can that be applied to heterogeneous material streams like material recovery? Started a company on an NSF grant. I mean, literally in that grassroots kind of classic story, growing there, then you look at levels of economic development in order to do that, to scale, and then you get from that level to seed funding. Now you have a viable technology that you can then look for private investment, venture capital, continuing to scale, private equity, et cetera. So it's a combination of the investment in technology, but also the role that grants and other types of solutions from government can help to stimulate, right, market creation. So that's the other thing, is that for a vital and healthy, recycling infrastructure, there has to be, the unit economics have to play out in order to recycle polypropylene, as an example, or PET thermoform and others. So there is then that mix of public and private, relationships and grants that stimulate innovation and also stimulate markets. And then the net goal of that, how do you create a remanufacturing infrastructure in the state, in the country? And that also means investment in plastics converters and technology there and kind of the broader value chain. And there's more.
Thanks, Chris. Well, that's a good transition then into your presentation and to chat a little bit about AMP Robotics and, your vision for utilizing these programs as you continue to grow your market facilities and impact in California.
Part of what we're doing at Dimension Robotics, our company has been around for, 2014. So, call it 8 years, commercialized for the last 4 years, and a rapid commercialization and adoption when it comes to, the overall material recovery infrastructure, plastics reclaimers. We also are applying technology and recovery, not just within traditional blue bin, but also in organics now, also into construction and demolition, into electronic scrap. So I think we also are looking at kind of the broader view of how can a technology be applied for the broader, solutions for different levels of technology for material recovery. So we look at it pretty holistically, and I kind of share this too, is that from a technology standpoint, from a government standpoint, there's also a very strong alignment that we look at for really the national recycling strategy, which I think is highly compatible, or what is happening also in California, where there's a focus on markets, infrastructure, reduction of contamination of materials and purity, how policy actually overlays and plays that with that, and also data. So I think at the heart of it, what we're also trying to collaborate with industry on is data capture in order to continue to advance what we want to solve as far as ultimately zero waste. So from a AMP standpoint, so we're located in Colorado, at least manufacturing is in Colorado. We have deployments of our technology systems, which are essentially robotic and automation systems across 25 different states in the U.S., as well as in Europe and Japan. We've grown from that early startup stage, as we mentioned, we were 12 people, and now we have well over 250. So rapid scale of technology that was basically driven by adoption of recycling and waste companies as far as the technology adoption path, but also ties back into the private and public investment. So getting that technology proven and also the appetite for private investment to come in to help scale. And that's always the challenge for an innovation company. How do you actually effectively scale commercially? And beyond that, continually to introduce new solutions that can benefit infrastructure. And just as a quick glance of what we're actually doing, so we've incorporated traditional, I would say, computer vision technology, kind of almost basically the way we kind of describe it is there is the facial recognition technology you might see about. Now we're applying that or have applied that to how do you actually identify and separate different types of plastics, polymers, paper, different grades of paper, metals, UBC, and doing it within a very complex commingled stream that you would see going through a recycling facility. And then all that data, all that information, this is where the artificial intelligence comes in, and you digitize all that information, helps then drive automation, drives intelligent robotics in order to remove materials. And from a very bespoke perspective, you know, a lot of our focus has been on also hard to recycle materials and also flexible capacity as we see things that continually change in a recycling stream, or with COVID, as we saw a huge swing from commercial materials coming into then residential spikes when we had shelter in place. So the flexibility of technology is also at the heart of what we're doing, and how do you actually apply technology that can go into the existing infrastructure out there, and that's also a really key component of what we've done. And then you know, with it is how do you then retain and utilize that information and continuously improve. We see 50 billion objects on an annual basis of different types of plastics. We're looking at different attributes of color, polymer, brands, all these different things that you and I would look at in order to identify what is what within a mixed stream. And that continuously gets improved, and that data then is continuously applied in order to improve the system. And then what we're looking at in the future, and hopefully near future, is how do you then start to apply that data and data capture to start to really understand what is going in and coming out of communities, what is actually recovered, how do we actually have collection standardization of data to work with infrastructure and with partners like Recology to continuously hit the goals that we want to achieve as a state, as a country, when it comes to recovered materials. So I think that's, you know, it's kind of probably the overview there. And I think one thing I'll mention too is, you know, as Laura hit on too, you know, there's the funding that's happening at the state level. You know, we also are involved in continuously pushing technology and next generation of technology, working with the Department of Energy as an example on advanced sensor technology, getting into the ability to have better types of ways of understanding the energy that is can come out of materials, how that actually plays into everything from organics to plastics and resins. So there is also that continuous life cycle, I would say, of technology that we know we need to have. So how can you adopt something now versus how do you continue to push the envelope of recovery in the future?
Thank you so much, Chris. And if I may, you know, as a moderator, I just offer my opinion here. I think, you know, what this technology also does is we've, you know, looked at and identified ways where government is doing very expensive waste characterization audits to look at different types of rates. And here's an example of where we can actually, you know, reduce the expense at some government and the government level of auditing and waste characterizing our waste stream. So, you know, when you reduce expense in one area, then, you know, it allows for funding of innovative technologies in other areas. So, you know, definitely wanted to mention that as well. So, Chris, do you have any specific insight into what your investors are thinking about the California funds that are coming on board and some of the programs?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably threefold. So definitely the proliferation of technology into material recovery facilities. And also, I mean, I think one thing I'll step back is how do you also make technology accessible to all communities, to all, you know, small, independently owned, you know, operated facilities, all the way down to, or all the way up to, you know, major regional leaders. So there's also an accessibility. So I think that's very much at the heart of this. So how do we actually do that? How do we do that in a way that can create the holistic infrastructure in California, get the technology adoption there? And you hit on that as far as the data component. I think there's also very much from an investor standpoint is how do we start to apply and demonstrate, you know, feasibility of data capture in order to inform what is in the stream, how to create, you know, better solutions and use of data to standardize collection and measurement. And we see that with, you know, you mentioned the upcoming feasibility grant to do that. And that's also a partnership that then, how you then start to work with plastics reclaimers and rest of the supply chain in order to demonstrate that, or value chain, so we truly have a circular economy. So from an investment standpoint, that's definitely the case. I think also, you know, I know that we'll at some point we'll talk about policy, but then the incorporation of policy and then of course regs, and how does that ultimately influence where we need to be as an industry? And then lastly, making sure that lawmakers and others understand that sometimes technology is backed into a corner that, oh, in a year, you know, whatever, 2050, you know, we'll have some solution, et cetera. That's not the case. I mean, what has happened rapidly advancing again in California at a breakneck piece or speed is true commercial feasibility, not even feasibility, adoption, you know, that's happening. So when we're making decisions in order to hit a goal in 2025 or 2030, that has to be taken in consideration now, because you don't want to get boxed into what maybe was thought about 10 years ago versus mm-hmm. what's today.
It's a really good point. Well, now that we've sort of, you know, covered all the presentations and asked questions, I want to get into a little bit more like, you know, philosophical questions, if I may, or general questions, not so focused on the technical aspect of this piece. But, this is for Treasurer Ma. You know, you've been working on policy solutions for the waste and recycling industry your entire career in state and local government. And you've toured, like I mentioned, you've toured more waste and recycling facilities than any other elected official that I know of. So what is that that gravitates you toward working with this industry so much? Why is it a passion?
Yeah, so I moved to San Francisco back in 1988, and I got elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors in 2002. And we had a diversion goal of, I think, like 60% at the time, and we wanted to move it to 75% because our landfill was going to fill up. And that really started my questioning and interest and obsession with garbage and landfills. And I just want to give two examples of bills, because all of you have a role in shaping policy if you don't like what's going on or you need changes. But like I said before, we need to hear from you. So I'll give you my two bills. Actually, Recology came to me in 2010 and said Solano County passed a measure, Measure E, back in the 80s. And the Sierra Club wanted to enforce this, this measure by banning any garbage coming into Solano County. And our composting from Recology was going to Solano County, so they said, would you help us carry this bill? And of course I said yes. Now, going against the Sierra Club as a Democrat, not very popular, okay? So we had to figure out, number one, explain to the members that we have an integrated waste management board for this specific reason, to really create equity in terms of where our garbage goes. We have a lot of landfills, a lot of recycling material that needs to be recycled. So in this case, I have 120 members of the legislature. For every member, we prepared packets, individual, customized packets on where their garbage went. And when people saw that, they were like, oh, we don't want to get involved in this. Please, Fiona, just fix it, you know? Right? So that kind of, that data and that information was very, very helpful, because people realized that, ooh, this is not just a Solano County problem, this is a statewide problem, right? So we managed to, the first year, the bill got held by the president of the Senate, and people were upset, and I guess one company left. And I said, don't worry, sometimes it takes a little time. So then, 2 years later, we managed to pass it, and so now no county can ban trash or garbage, sorry, not trash, ban garbage or recycling coming into their counties. So that was a big bill. And then the second one I did was having to do with recycled asphalt material. And so CalSEMA, the California Construction and Industrial Materials Association, again, not another popular group amongst enviros, said other states have higher recycled asphalt goals. Like Texas, I guess, was allowing up to 50% of recycled asphalt into their roads and other projects. And Caltrans only had a 15% maximum allowance. And so
when you put that type of data in front of us, like, we like to be the leading edge. We like to be at the forefront. And Caltrans used to be at the forefront, but as years go by, you know, we were, like, falling behind. So I told CalSEMA, it was 15%. They wanted to go to 50%. And I said, listen, I need cover from you. I just can't have your lobbyists sit there next to me. I want to see your members come out. And for every member that comes out, that's going to be the percentage that I'm going to propose raising the number to.
I love that.
So, no, and I kept saying, they're like, you know, like, I go, you just can't complain to me in a room, like, show up. So if they wanted 50%, I needed 35 of their members to come. Only 30 of them showed up at committee. And so we set that cap, that new cap, at 45%, and we were able to pass it because we had bipartisan support on both sides. But that's the way you all need to get involved. You know, you can't expect us to sit there and take the arrows if there's no army behind us, right? And this is very important. I do a lot of affordable housing, and the housing folks don't want to share the bond resources. I keep saying, you can't build housing without garbage, without water, without other infrastructure, but they just want all of it themselves. And that's where we really need you all to kind of weigh in a little bit more with our legislators and policymakers.
Thank you, Fiona, for saying that. And, you know, that's why we're here today, to really bring government into the conversation about how vital and important government is becoming in our industry. As we move toward more aggressive recycling goals, it's going to be on the local governments and state governments to set those goals and achieve them. And guess where your local governments are going to be looking? At you guys, saying, how do we do this? So with that, Sal, you've been in this industry for how long? Remind me.
23 years.
Okay. So in your 23 years, how have you seen government's role evolve in this industry?
I've seen, it's been very helpful. I mean, it's really, there's been, government in California has really set the bar and gotten a lot more involved. Early in my career, we saw a lot of this change and progression and starting in San Francisco, mm-hmm. right? And being working for waste haulers outside of San Francisco early in my career, you would see that. You would see diversion. You would see, you know, new technology, new ideas, you know, the three-cart system, composting. And now we've seen what's happened in San Francisco happen statewide. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen the local and regional government say, we need to make this more, you know, throughout the entire state and standardize these type of programs. So, but when also, like we're talking about today, that public-private partnership is real important. I mean, especially projects like this, to invest in these facilities, we need long-term commitments. It's very capital intensive. And it's hard to do that without local government helping, grant programs. So it is that public-private partnership is what's made companies like ours successful, especially in this heavily regulated environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that's a really good point. I mean, I just think about, and I started in the industry 15 years ago. And how they've grown, and the different roles mm-hmm. now, and employees that we have. I mean, you know, in local government, maybe there was, you know, the Department of Public Works director, and that was in charge of the solid waste contract. But now we have zero waste experts, recycling coordinators, you know, maybe 10, 20, 50, 100 people in a department, depending on the size of the jurisdiction. But certainly just the size of...
And I think what's driven a lot of it in California is AB 32, the Climate mm-hmm. Action Plan. Mm-hmm. That started, really kind of kicked off a lot of these efforts. And you have the, you know, jurisdictions are responsible. So they're looking for adding those resources and asking us to help out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what's, you know, to be successful as a state in terms of diversion and greenhouse gas emission reduction, you need that.
Mm-hmm.
It's creating a lot of jobs. I think about 939 when I first heard about that, about the jobs it was going to create, and it has. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't for 939, we wouldn't be here.
Yeah,
you know, I wouldn't have been able to start my career in some of the positions that I started off with. So it's been really good for the economy, you know, and obviously great for the environment. But so, yeah, you can see, you know, 939 was really for us in our state, that's really kicked it off. And 1383 is kind of like 939 2.0 to me. So I think it's good.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Yeah. And you know, what's different about AB 939 that required 50% recycling way back in the late 80s and SB 1383 is that 1383 puts it on the local governments and said, you're responsible. But again, the local governments look to their partners and their haulers to say, help us achieve this.
So just to end that, we don't look at the regulation as an issue. It's an opportunity for a private employee-owned company like ours to grow and help.
Oh, thank you. Laura, you know, Chris touched a little bit about on policy and how that really drives things. From a policy perspective, what's coming down the pike in terms of, like, you know, we see 1383, that needs a lot of funding. What's coming next that's going to need a lot of funding and require more public-private partnership? Like, what can we brace for, I guess?
The circular economy. Circular economy in California. I mean, we talked about it a little bit already. Yes, organics too, but also more traditional recyclables. I know that the legislature has been working on plastic packaging policy for at least 3 years now, trying to find a solution that works for everyone. We talk a lot about, okay, so the circular economy, and I think a significant issue within that discussion is that recycling has been mislabeled as broken. Recycling's broken. The system's broken. The system's not broken. We just haven't brought the circle all the way around yet. So in my opinion, you know, I talk to Sal and other waste haulers and recyclers, and what I hear all the time is everything is recyclable. Everything is recyclable, but there needs to be a market for it. Otherwise, we're not going to do it. So it's not that the recycling system is broken. It's not that the programs are broken. Could it be better? Sure, of course. And that's why we have all of this money to invest in infrastructure development and improvement, and we need to optimize our collection and processing systems and programs and infrastructure. Sure. But really what it is the market for recycled feedstock. So this is the first time in California over the last few years as we've been trying to develop this circular economy, plastic packaging policy, that the producers and manufacturers have actually really been brought to the table, and we've said to them, you have a role to play in all of this. So you make the product, you sell it, we use it, we recycle it. You got to buy it back. You got to take it back, and you have to use it, and you have to make new product. So this keeps cutting out. Thank you. So that's what I like to focus on when we talk about circular economy. There's not a problem with recycling. We just have not completed the circle, and to do that, we need market development, whatever that looks like. Investment in market development, incentives for buying and using recycled feedstock, minimum recycled content standards, better product design on the front end so that by the time it comes back, the producers want to buy back their own material. I mean, anytime you hear a producer or manufacturer touting proprietary technology, it just means unrecyclable material. Can't use it. And if they're not willing to buy it back, then that's the incentive they need to change product design at the front so they'll buy it on the back.
And I just want to add a couple things. I do a lot of ag tours as well, but there is a lot of pressure now for the ag community to use labels that don't stick on permanently. And so I think Driscoll's is doing that now, and so that, you know, when you do recycle it, you can actually recycle it and not have to, you know, throw it in the other pile because you can't get the sticker off of it. Also, grape vines. Before, if you were a wine grape grower and you had a disease or your crop was at its, you know, life expectancy, they would just burn it. And now there is, you know, pressure not to burn anymore. And so thinking about how are we going to recycle these, and dispose of these wine grape vines that are intermingled with the metal supports. You cannot, after a while, separate the two. And so that is another thing. And then there was an article yesterday on the bottle bill, how it's not really working in California because we keep closing all of these redemption facilities. And I know that wine and spirits are also being talked about in terms of recycling, because I drink a lot of wine. I feel bad that I still throw it in you know, the blue bin, but I know it's not being recycled. It should be recycled. So I know that is in the works as well.
Yeah, certainly bottle bills are things that are being looked at and modernized as well, and pulling in other types of products and brands and manufacturers is definitely a way to do that. Chris, I see you have something to talk about on the policy
side. I'm so excited.
I think the one thing I did want to hit on too is, I guess there's twofold. One is the data component. I'm going to kind of keep on harping on this because this is a true story. My daughter, second grader, knows that there's only a 9% plastics recycling rate because she hears it all the time before she learned to tie her shoes. Now, she learned to tie her shoes last week, so it's kind of recent, and that's completely accurate. But I think as an industry and collaboratively, you know, knowing what's actually happening, how that's improving, because I think that loses a trust in the public eye, of course, about how things are performing, and I don't think that's accurate. And I think that also that gets lost a lot in translation. So the more that we're able to, you know, drive recovery and show these amazing progressive wins that are happening, you know, that has to be demonstrated. So I think that's like a big thing. And I think the other component is that the alignment of policy with also, we're working more and more with brands where they have a new design coming out or they want to go ahead and make sure a material is compatible with polypropylene as an example. But it might be a different form factor. It might be something that's, you know, creating, you know, a big level of tension at the recovery level because all of a sudden, you know, it is recyclable, but it's something that can't be economically recovered. But then there's these huge PCR goals that they have. So how do we align policy with these PCR goals that a brand might have and manufacturer? They have to step up, obviously, in order to create that market development, as Laura mentioned. But also at the same time, there has to be a broader collaboration, I think, between public and private design, et cetera, and try to close that gap. And I think that we're starting to see that.
Yes, bringing all the stakeholders to the table. It's difficult, but it always ends up good.
They're always invited, though.
Yeah, yeah. Pressure under pressure. You guys know that song. Now the time has come for the audience to ask questions. So there is a mic in the middle of the room. We'd love for anybody who has a burning question to ask it. So here we go.
Sean Goglin, Chambersburg Waste Paper. I work at a MRF, and we're in the beginning stages of getting the zoning permits and building permits for a transfer station. And we're talking about trying to get some grant money to hopefully get some optical sorters or something to increase our ability to take more plastic. I was just wondering the first or maybe the best route to take in Pennsylvania for trying to secure some grant money for a transfer station. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for that question. I'll send that one over to Laura, the grant expert.
Yeah, great question. Obviously, I work primarily in California, but have researched grants throughout the country. So I can't tell you right here off the top of my head what's available for you in Pennsylvania. But what we have seen all over the country is a lot of money, you know, for all different kinds of applicants, but primarily a lot of municipalities. So if there's a grant available, and we've seen grants that are very specific or very broad that say, you know, we'll give you money to buy carts, we'll give you money to build a MRF for a transfer station, we'll give you money for equipment. So you know, we can talk after if you'd like about where you're located and where you're looking. My advice would be to you know, find the municipality you're targeting, see what's available there, and then go talk to them and say, hey, there's this grant available for you. We'll apply for you or help you with your application process, and that would be a great partnership opportunity there. So I can't answer that specific to you in Pennsylvania right now, but we can talk.
Yeah, and I don't know if there's any big companies that are located in your state or by your stations. Here in California, the banks are stepping up to help build affordable housing. The tech companies that we have a housing crisis and they can't hire people, you know, based on the cost of housing. So they are putting money into different programs like for housing. But I think we should try to get them to expand and put it into garbage and recycling too, because they just don't understand the nexus. And a lot of times they don't even know how to deploy this money. So they still have money sitting around. You know, a couple companies committed like $1 billion for housing. But like I said, you can't build housing without recycling. So if they help us build the recycling, then maybe we can get the housing built faster. That just came to mind.
Thank you. Write that down.
And I think also collaboratively with public funding and, you know, using your point on Pennsylvania, there's also a lot of private funding as we're looking to create access, collection access, recovery access, and we're involved in a number of coalitions that kind of come throughout the value chain that are focused on that as well. So I think the collaboration of those different levels of funding access really can create the goals that you're looking to achieve.
But great way of thinking about it, looking for grant funds and ways to get support there financially. Any other questions? Come on. Well, we covered the topic, so okay, here we go. Thank you.
I do have a question. My name is Greg Beal. I work with the State of Texas Alliance for Recycling. I'm on their policy subcommittee, and I've been tasked with writing a white paper to the legislator about developing funding for, based on our recycling market development plan that was a report that came out 2 years ago. So some of the funding we're asking for is to develop a recycling board and a recycling center, you know, using universities to hopefully be act as think tanks to properly, you know, complete that circular economy. How do we keep the local processing within the state? Have you developed anything or seen anything in the past in California as far as having a recycling board or a think tank that can kind of bring all the groups together and kind of convince the legislators to vote for more funding? The way we're going to get the funding is trying to increase the tipping fee taxes to fund this, which shouldn't
go. Yeah. So in California, we have an organization called the California Foundation for the Economy and the Environment, CFE. And they do really great roundtables, legislators, stakeholders, government, other, you know, best practices folks, and they do these conferences and these international trips. So I got them 3 years ago to do one on recycling. And I think that's a great opportunity to put everyone in a room, and you say it's not going to be, you know, broadcast, nobody can attribute any remarks, and then you get real honest people in the room saying these are the problems, and then you can start solving them. And then the fact that you have legislators in the room too, they take these ideas and what they're hearing back to make those policy decisions. So I think doing some sort of, you know, public-private roundtable discussion, not just with universities, because universities, they don't talk to legislators necessarily, right? Private sector doesn't talk to universities, so having that mix I think would be helpful.
And there's also on the public-private side, this is on a national level, but also starting to localize, very much localized on a state level, is the recycling partnership. So we do a lot with the recycling partnership as an NGO, and it brings a lot of stakeholders together, and also looks at how do you actually, again, drive community access, collection access, fund infrastructure and other things. So if you haven't already, definitely would advocate and happy to make introductions.
But thank you so much for coming to this session. Hopefully you'll leave thinking about how you can go talk to your government about your needs and who are the right stakeholders to bring into the conversation. So thank you very much, and thank you to our panelists.